my name is Jill Zamorski, and welcome to Reading and Drinking on the SOM TV Podcast Network. On today's show, I am going to be talking about a book entitled Nosedive, A Field Guide to the World's Smells by Harold McGee. So when I was a kid, I had a friend who didn't have a sense of smell. And it never really occurred to me how that might affect your daily life. And he summed it up very amusingly and very succinctly once. And he said, well, to me, a fart is just a funny noise. And it really cracked me up. But this was way before my career in wine. And so I don't think I fully grasped just the impact of smells on history and life as we know it and what would become my life as I know it. This episode is sponsored by Blinders, a wine-based card game from the creators of SOM. Even if you've never blind tasted before, or if you're a pro, this game is for wine lovers of all levels. Get 30% off with Reading 30, that's Reading 30, for your first purchase of Blinders today. So Harold McGee he's a really neat guy. This is not his first book, I should say. I have actually read one other book that he has published. It's called On Food and Cooking. And he writes about the science of food and cooking. And he's won numerous awards. And he has a really fantastic voice. I don't know if he's ever taught. Well, actually, the jacket of this book says that he has been a visiting lecturer at Harvard University's science and cooking courses. And I believe that's the same course that my old chef, Jose Andres, used to be a visiting lecturer as well. But I think that his ability to explain complicated subjects would make him an absolutely astounding professor. This book is huge. It is deceptively huge. It's probably like 7x9. I have a hardback cover and it's not that thick, but not including the copious additional references and the index, this book is nearly 600 pages long. And I'm realizing as I was making my notes that it has very thin paper. And so it's very deceptively long. This is a dense, dense book. And full disclaimer, this is a podcast about wine books. And this is not a wine book, but it was published in 2020, and I saw a lot of people posting about it on social media, and honestly, the fact that it came out in 2020 is fairly interesting because obviously 2020 was the year that the world got blasted by COVID, and of course, one of the well-known symptoms of COVID-19 is the loss of temporary, hopefully, the loss of a sense of smell. And so a book that explains where smells come from and how we smell and what makes things smell a certain way. It was very timely. I don't think it was planned that way. I believe this book was 5 to 10 years in the research and the making. So this book is organized in an interesting way. There's a very, and I will talk about it, a very interesting preface that describes sort of the inspiration for the thought process that led to the formation of this book. And then information about how we actually smell. And then smells are broken up into various categories. From start to finish, we basically have a 14 billion year timeline. And we start with the simplest smells, you know, space dust and how matter was created and how atoms combined to actually form molecules and what makes molecules volatile and smelly. And from there, it moves into animals and animal bodies and animal signals. And of course, the human animal and all of the things that make us smell good and bad. And then it moves into actually things that smell good generally, which is plants. And from plants, land plants, flowers, edible herbs, roots, and seeds. Then it moves into the land, soil, fungi, stones, waters. And then there is actually a section that details wine and other fermented things. It's a part called Chosen Smells, and it details fragrances, cooked foods, and then cooked and fermented foods. And of course, wine would be considered a fermented food as it's the fermented product of grape juice. So the preface of this book is entitled My First Grouse. And before I explain what that refers to, the author sets out a couple of terms. And he defines this idea of how we smell and what we smell and the wide world of smells as something he calls the osmocosm. And I think he made up this word, but the etymology is from the ancient Greek for smell or odor. And as he says, quite poetically, the osmocosm contains multitudes, thousands of different molecules, at least, and possibly thousands of thousands. So how do we smell? And he explains this, and I feel like it's worth, well, explaining to you. The way we smell, we literally bring microscopic particles into our own body. And I will say that reading this book has really made me think a lot about smells. I mean, look, I'm a sommelier, and I think that I have a relatively heightened sense of smell. And I'm very observant of the world around me, find yourself out on a walk. You know, a couple weeks ago, I had a really bad headache, but I took my dog out on a walk and we walked by someone's house and they were clearly doing laundry. And there was this like sickly sweet, heavy, warm aroma of like dryer sheets. And it made my headache 10 times worse. And that's like a super powerful memory because your sense memory is really, really powerful. But what's really crazy is that more than our sense of touch or hearing or sight, our sense of smell and sense of taste, we're actually taking microscopic particles of something else into our body. So when we're smelling something, vaporized particles, airborne volatile molecules enter us and they momentarily become part of us, which is kind of disgusting if you think about smelling something that is not delicious. But basically molecules, you know, they're invisibly small particles of matter. They're the building blocks of life. And essentially what happens is while tasting something, your taste receptors are on your tongue in your taste buds. And your taste buds are looking out for a handful of specific molecules, pieces of items that dissolve in your saliva from the food that you put in your mouth, or as the author says, other materials that we choose to chew on, suck, or lick. And we have about 50 or so different types of taste receptors, and they give rise to your basic senses of taste: sweet, sour, salty, bitter, and umami. So your sense of taste, and we know this, we talk about this a lot, you're only able to discern certain flavors. However, your sense of taste is largely driven by your sense of smell. Your sense of smell, however, arises from two patches of skin out of sight inside your head, behind and a little bit below your eyes. And it's a very small surface area, less than about a tenth of your tongue surface, about a square inch. And there are, and I'm going to have to read this here, about 400 or so different kinds of odor receptors. And they recognize molecules carried in the air we breathe in and out. And smell is on the lookout, not for just a handful of molecules, but for whatever molecules just happen to be in the air. Now, your smell receptors don't happen to notice the great majority of what's in the air because the majority of molecules, nitrogen, oxygen, carbon dioxide, and water, their presence is not significant because they're in such large quantities. They're always there. But your smell receptors are very sensitive to the molecules that come and go, that give clues to what's going on around us. So everything that you smell that smells delicious and everything that you smell that smells horrible, little bits of that item are actually making their way into your brain. You can stew on that for a moment. So the key thing with determining whether something smells is that the molecules have to be volatile, which means in terms of a, you know, chemical standpoint, they have to be able to evaporate or escape from their solid or liquid materials as a gaseous vapor. And so a lot of things we simply can't smell because they are inert. They're not volatile molecules. And other things that we smell, they're not, for example, like a potato or an apple. There isn't a molecule that smells like an apple or a potato. It's a collection of lots of different molecules. And together, essentially, all of these items are received by our scent receptors and they essentially create a report to our brain. And this all happens subconsciously. And so we create this, you know, experience of I'm smelling all of these combinations of molecules and I realize now that I'm smelling coffee. And so it happens, you know, incredibly fast, but it gives us this impression of what we're actually experiencing. So that's how we smell. Now, the original purpose of taste and smell is, it's kind of interesting. It essentially evolved to enable animals to recognize, you know, good and bad, to recognize something as good food and ingest it, or to recognize something as toxic or spoiled and to avoid it or to expel it, to sense danger from a predator or a fire and escape it. We didn't evolve our sense of smell to dissect coffee and its volatile ingredients. It had a much more primal intent. Now, the introduction, which is entitled My First Grouse, or the preface, which is entitled My First Grouse, details the experience this author had when he ate something kind of unusual. So he, you know, he's a writer on food and science, and this was back in 2005. And he found himself in Scotland, and he went out with a chef friend, and they ordered a very traditional lunch. And on that menu was grouse. So a grouse is a game bird, and it was in season, and he had never had one. And so he thought, now's a good time. And it came, as he said, whole roasted, rare and plainly, on a slice of toast with a tuft of watercress. And he says that he expected to enjoy it, but he did not expect that the first bite would leave him speechless. And it did. He was so completely absorbed and almost repulsed that he couldn't help but wonder why. And he gives a little bit of information about a grouse. And look, I'm an adventurous eater. I'll try anything. But this, I don't know that I've ever had grouse. And I'm not sure based on his description that I ever want to. Because as he says, it's a true game bird, living in the wild on the open heathlands, scrounging for food, evading predators, often infected with gut parasites that make them more easily scented by foxes and dogs. And then they're driven from cover, shot on the wing, and then their carcasses are matured, hung for several days, guts included, to tenderize them and intensify their flavor. So, delicious, especially served whole roasted and rare. But he had this intense reaction to it, and he didn't know why. And that's one thing that we explore in this book, is that one key characteristic of our ability to smell is that if we've never experienced something before, we don't have the vocabulary to articulate what it is we're smelling. And he'd never had a grouse before. And so that's why it was so shocking. And also the idea that something can only be new once. And so this is his first experience with this very pungent, very kind of feral food. And he had no idea what to do with it. So it sets a really interesting stage. Molecules they're the building blocks of life. And they are a collection of multiple atoms. And I did say that this book has something of a timeline. And it starts 14 billion years ago with the Big Bang. And the intro to this book is, well, it's a little bit based in astrophysics because it explains how that happened and where we get these molecules that we can now smell. The long and short of it is, of course, the idea of the Big Bang theory that 14 billion years ago, there was unimaginably an explosive flash and the universe expanded outwards. And as it expanded, it cooled down. And as it cooled down, the matter and the energy that we know on Earth began to appear. And gravitational force led, microscopic bits to condense and form together, starting first with electromagnetic energy becoming little packets called photons. And along with photons, we got the three kinds of raw matter, which is the components of an atom, protons, neutrons, and electrons. And the first solitary proton formed the nucleus of hydrogen. So hydrogen was the first element, and then it was followed by helium and lithium. And this kind of over and over, like condensing, expanding, contracting, led to the formation of numerous elements. This kind of happens over and over. And what really is important for our sense of smell is when carbon is formed. So carbon atoms are pretty unique. And the reason this is referred to as hero carbon is because it has a really unique property to bond with other atoms and form very distinct molecules. And these molecules can then change form and give rise to, eventually, billions of years later, the sense of taste. And he does a very good job of explaining how this works. And he tells a story about making caramel. So to make caramel, you start off with just sugar, right? And imagine you have a pot, and you put it on your stove, and you fill it with just white refined sugar. And sugar tastes sweet, but it doesn't have an aroma. You put the sugar in the pot, you turn on the heat, you stir it around. And after a few minutes, that solid sugar turns into clear liquid, but there's still no aroma. But if you keep heating it, that liquid will turn yellow and it'll start to smell, and then it'll turn brown and it'll get darker and stronger smelling. And in the end, you've made a sour, bitter, sweet, richly aromatic substance. So from one substance, you've made many, from simplicity, complexity. And I think that's a really good analogy. One, because caramel is delicious. But two, most of us have experience with that. And if we don't have experience with astrophysics, we can at least kind of extrapolate like, oh, okay, that makes sense. We start with something simple. And from that, we get something very complex. So we have all these different molecules. How do we know what they smell like? Well, this is pretty interesting. And I will say throughout the book, in addition to referring to the protagonist of our osmocosm, Hero Carbon, Harold McGee routinely calls on the readers plural, as smell explorers. And I love this because in my mind, throughout the 600 pages of this book, every time he encouraged his smell explorers to come along on a olfactory adventure, all I could think about was like scouts, whether you're like a Girl Scout or a Boy Scout or a Brownie or whatever, and how you would earn little merit badges for different tasks or skills. And this is just in my mind. And I just imagine like little noses running around with like sashes, and every smell you would like get a little badge. And I just thought it was the cutest thing in the whole wide world. But we're all led by the troop leader, Harold McGee. So if that helps you in your mind's eye to be a smell explorer, well then come along, camper, because it's going to be an interesting ride. So there actually is a way that we can determine how things smell, and it's pretty fascinating, actually. So chemists have worked for a long time at cataloging all of these molecules that emanate from foods and rocks and, all different types of matter. And ever since the late 1940s, they've developed and refined machines that can basically do like what a prism does with light. It can separate it into its constituent particles. And the machines that do this, they're called gas chromatographs. And what happens is you can feed in a teeny tiny amount, like micrograms of whatever substrate you're wanting to analyze into a gas chromatograph. And it pulses out the component volatiles and they exit it. And they get passed into another instrument, a mass spectrometer, which will analyze the chemical makeup, allowing the chemist to sort of correlate the specific molecules. Now, in addition to spitting out the volatile molecules into a mass spectrometer, the chromatograph's volatile pulses can also be passed into a tube that leads to the nose of a, quote, very patient human detector who sniffs and names the kind of smell that she or he detects at a given retention time. This is this really interesting idea, but it's, you know, what we know is a couple of things. Molecules are involved in smells, and we know what these single molecule smells are somehow aggregated in our brains to form, you know, a concept. But it's a combination of both chemical analysis and also sensory observation. And of course, we're all different. And we all have different experiences and different childhoods. And so much of your perception of smell is sense memory. So there is a subjective component to that. But hand in hand, the gas chromatograph sensory analysis is abbreviated GCO. So chromatic olfactory. So once we now understand how molecules came to be in space and time, we just essentially have to fast forward. Now, look, this book does not fast forward. It details through millennia and millennia of millennia just how, you know, more compounds were formed and the great oxygenation event of the Earth and how it gave rise to single cell microorganisms and microbes and how they came out of the water. And it details all of this. And we certainly don't need to go over that in this podcast. But once we get into, well, the bulk of this book is when we start to talk about and analyze specific smells. The flavors and the smells rather can be grouped into various kind of categories, microbial smells. And oftentimes the same words get used over and over and over, and they sound fairly foul, but it just combinations of these things aren't necessarily. And some are sour and cheesy smells, and some are sweaty smells, and some are fecal smells, and some are ammonia or fish smells. And look, all of those might sound fairly disgusting in some combination or another, but the world of smelling is complex, and these components can come together and actually make some really quite delicious smelling items. Hero carbon, you know, once carbon was created, it cleared the air of a lot of the dominant sulfuric smells that existed in primordial Earth, and it started to replace those sulfuric molecules with more carbon-based molecules and smells that we know today. Once we get into chapter 4, which starts talking all about animals, this is maybe, and I'm not someone who is squeamish, but there's some nasty in this chapter. And it talks about particularly how animal bodies are so unusually rich in these molecules because we actually take in other ingredients and we metabolize them. And of course, we expel them. And so this book, in no particular order, details really all kinds of characteristics, but there's some fascinating information. In particular, there is a small subsection of this chapter called Animals Dismantled, the Bouquet of Death. And there is actually a molecule. It's called cadaverine. And I will say this, the molecules that are associated with certain types of matter usually have very straightforward names. If something smells particularly fishy and putrid, well, putrescine is the name of that molecule. Or for example, the decaying flesh smell, that's cadaverine. And this is really interesting. And of course, this has nothing to do with wine. Heaven forbid you ever find a wine that smells like a dead animal. But it's interesting because having nothing to do with wine, the study of these volatile smells can, you know, people study these if you think about like murder shows and how you discover, you know, the location of a dead body or how long a body has been dead. All of this stuff comes down to so much as a sense of a chemical smell. So it's pretty interesting. We don't just spend time talking about dead animals. We talk about horse excrement and why manure actually has positive connotations from how it, you know, came to be known and used. And then, interestingly, there is a section all on pet smells. And look, I have a dog, and I have been thinking more and more about her and the smells that, you know, animals can emanate. And I'm not just talking about like picking up her poop. I'm talking about things like wet dog. And that's a phrase that we talk about sometimes for spoiled wine. If it's corked wine, and oftentimes the smell of wet dog is something that's used as a descriptor. And I will say, for a book that's not about wine, just about smells, one thing that's so fascinating throughout the length of this book is that there are associations and smells that do tie into wine. But the smell of a wet dog is discussed in here, as well as the smell of dog paws, how they smell like tortilla chips. And this book is peppered through with charts. And the charts usually break down the component smells, what the molecules that are responsible for those smells are, and then what the sources are. So, you know, component smells of dogs, and then what the molecules are that are responsible for those, and then what their sources are. Pretty fascinating stuff. Now, we work through skunks and all kinds of smelly animals. And then the chapter on humans and human smells is particularly interesting because, well, we are a stinky creature. And all of that is detailed in here. Now, once we get into plants and other factors, it gets a little bit more interesting. Talking about all the different flowers that exist in the world today, and floral descriptions are quite common for wine. What's so interesting is that a lot of the flowers that we can easily have access to, like in a floral shop, aren't as aromatic as they historically once were, because due to overbreeding for sturdy stems or not wilting or showy blooms, they have sort of been selected away from their strong aromatic sense. But it details, you know, why a flower is formed to attract a pollinator and how plants differ from animals in terms of their smells and what the purposes of those smells are for. It's some really fascinating reading. I digress, and I realize that not much of this is about wine, but it is pretty funny. And there is a particular discussion in flowers, and most flowers, of course, smell nice, but not all flowers do. And there's a small inclusion about, well, one of the nastiest flowers, I think, that actually exists, and it's called the corpse flower. And this got me all excited. I got excited about a flower. Because when I first moved to Chicago, a friend of mine, this was like 5 years ago, a friend of mine told me about a special exhibition that was happening at the Chicago Botanic Garden. And the Botanical Garden has several examples of a flower that's called a Titan arum, also known as a corpse flower. And this is a flower that's native to the rainforests of Indonesia. And it's famous for its bloom. Now, these are rare flowers, and so they're oftentimes cultivated and carefully cared for in botanical gardens, but they only really bloom like once every 10 years. And once they bloom, they are quite famous for the size and stench and the beauty of their flower. And apparently the stench is akin to the smell of a rotting corpse. So I was all excited in 2015 that Spike, that was the name of this particular flower, was all set to bloom. And they literally had a website with like Bloom Watch. And we were all set to go out there. And sadly, so sad, Spike, he failed to perform. It lacked the energy to bloom in 2015. But I am told, while I did not see it or experience it, Spike did have a heroic return in 2018 and actually did bloom. But the corpse flower, I mean, it sounds so nasty, right? Like a giant flower that's like the stalk before it blooms is like 10 feet tall, and it smells like a rotting corpse, which I've actually never smelled. But I was ready to queue up and like be in a line to wait to sniff and experience this, because I guess I'm a smell explorer. I want to get that badge. So I need to bookmark the Chicago Botanical Gardens webpage, because next time one of these bad boys blooms, I'm there for it. I'm here for that smell. But it is so fascinating. And of course, this all ties back to why would a plant evolve that smell? And it's because the smell of a rotting corpse attracts certain types of insects, and insects are pollinators. So we think about bees and butterflies pollinating flowers, but also beetles and flies pollinate, you know, they reproduce oftentimes in carrion. And so it attracts a certain type of bug that could pollinate it, but it also could be a defense mechanism and keep away a potential predator. Because if it smells bad, you're not going to eat it. And I don't know who would be big enough or want to eat something that smelled that bad. So I was super delighted to see inclusion of the corpse flower in this book. Now, this book, like I said, it's like 600 pages, not even including the references in the index. And there are footnotes throughout, and there's pages. There might be 30 pages of additional reading to support all of the research. It's a little bit intense. But the index is particularly fascinating, because if you weren't sure that this book was as comprehensive as it was, if you didn't want to take my word for it, you could just thumb through the index and see just how many different smells and aromas it covers. It's pretty impressive. So moving on from flowers, we kind of go into a couple of interesting sections. Fruit, of course, and I will say this. A lot of the compounds that are responsible for the aromatic character of wines, you may have heard of. We talk about pyrazine in Sauvignon Blanc or Cabernet Sauvignon, and it's that compound that smells like a green bell pepper or cut grass. Or we talk about linalool, which smells like roses or lychee, or these different compounds that if we want to geek out and get a little technical, like they're known entities. And it is interesting to see them here and to see that those compounds are not just present in wine grapes, but you know, other fruits and other flowers. And so there's a lot of overlap. And it explains why sometimes we can just generically say that something smells fruity, because a lot of these compounds exist in a lot of different fruits. Now, one of the things that I thought was so fascinating about this book, well, fascinating and like validating, is that it touches on a lot of the same subjects that the previous book I reviewed last week about vineyard geology. It touches on some of those same subjects, because if you listened to that podcast, hopefully you did, one of the takeaways is that we talk about wine and we oftentimes talk about this sense of minerality, the sense of terroir, that you can smell and taste the earth in the wine. And Alex Maltman, the author of Vineyard Rocks and Geology, did a fairly handy job of dismissing most of those assertions. And, you know, said that these minerals are largely non-volatile, they're not bioavailable, and it's a little bit of a stretch to think that we would smell or taste something that was taken up by the roots of a plant and then the result of the fermented juice of the fruit of that plant. And look, that resonated with me. It rocked my world, but it made a lot of sense. And Harold McGee backs it up. So in chapter 14, he talks about the land, soil and fungi and stone. And it's really interesting because he tackles a couple of concepts that I mentioned, petrichor, which is that smell of like wet rocks. And he says exactly what, you know, I've come to believe, that it's not the smell of the rock. It's actually the smell of volatile organic molecules that have settled on the rock, and they are made volatile when rain hits them. And so it's the smell of a wet rock because the water volatilizes these molecules, and that's how we're able to smell them. He tackles geosmin, which is sort of this like earthy smell that sometimes we get in wines, and where that comes from and how it's not actually earth, it's bacterial in nature. And there's some really fascinating information in here about the kind of symbiosis between earth and the smells that we then associate. And one of my favorite kind of specific items that he isolates and talks about is, well, if a corpse flower sounds disgusting and nasty and huge, then let's talk about something that smells amazing and special and small. And that is a truffle. Now, not the chocolate truffle type, but truffles that are grown in the ground. It's a fungus. And he does a real kind of interesting and a deep dive on truffles and explains, for example, what the smells are in specific truffles and how they're each their own kind of miniature ecosystem. And I mean, he explains, if you've ever been in a restaurant and truffle season is typically at the end of a year, usually in October and November. If you're not sure what truffle season entails, I highly recommend you listen to Suit and Tie by Justin Timberlake and Jay-Z. And he actually explains the reason why, if you were in a restaurant and they offer to shave truffles tableside over your risotto or your pasta or whatever, why oftentimes those truffles are presented in a box, because of the volatility of the molecules, it's more intense when it's whole and intact. And by shaving those truffles, you allow for a great deal of surface area, but presenting the truffles all together in the box with their intact kind of intensity of aroma really gives you that like heady blast of truffly deliciousness. And so again, nothing to do with wine except for the fact that white truffles pair really well with aged Barolo and aged white Burgundy and red Burgundy and aged Champagne. But it's one of my favorite things. It's one of the most distinctive smells. And it's also, this book also covers synthetic aromas. There is, at the very end, in the same section as wine and fermented food, synthetic aromas. And there's a whole industry that has risen up replicating smells that we encounter in nature. And they're able to do this by analyzing what the molecules are that are responsible for these smells and then synthesizing them in a different form. So if we talk about the amazing truffle, then we can also talk about truffle oil that is, you know, can be made in a cheaper and less intense and less delicious manner. Now, in a later section of this chapter, he talks about, well, it's called Wet Up, rain-released smells of soil, stone, and air. And this is pretty fascinating. So he actually decides that petrichor and the root of that word, petra or petri, is the root of that means stone. And he decides and stipulates, and more power to him, he's the expert, that a better word, instead of referring to the smell of stones, because we know that petrichor is not the smell of stones, it is the smell of the volatile organic molecules that are on the surface of the stones, that it should be called gaiacor. Gaia, the root of that, meaning earth. So it's more the smell of earth. So he then, once he stipulates that that is how it should be called, he continues to do that. But he makes an interesting case, and it's not till the end of the book that we really start to even talk about wine with any sort of detail. But he does say that in the wine world, certain white wines from cool climates have been said to carry this aroma of struck flint or gun flint. And the French term is goutte de pierre à fusil. And look, if you're not like firing a musket, then you probably don't know what this smells like. But it kind of smells like firecrackers or like a cap gun. And apparently, and this is what we learned, that nearly 20 years ago, French chemists, wine chemists, connected that aroma, that gunflint aroma, to particular sulfur compounds in the grapes and the finished wine. And what's interesting is that these compounds are a relative of the cat pea and the grapefruit thiols that we do see in some of these cool climate white wines. But the smell of struck flint is unlikely to involve such complex organic molecules. So what it is that they discovered this because a laboratory in Geneva, this is so gross, they were studying ways to ameliorate the odors of latrines. And they just happened to notice that a tank of hydrogen sulfide, which is common in latrines, had changed smells from a standard rotten egg smell to something that they associated with struck flint, as well as the smell of cold fireworks or the smell associated with a dentist drilling teeth. Mm. And they found that the hydrogen sulfide in their tank had been oxidized to form very different and unusual sulfur volatiles, like hydrogen sulfide, but with an additional sulfur, one or two sulfur atoms. And these are called sulfanes. And they were able to identify the same sulfanes when they struck together two pieces of flint. So apparently when flint is struck with another hard material, the focused energy of the impact helps oxidize some of the sulfides in the flint into sulfanes. So as is true of gaiacor, the raw ingredients of struck flint smell originate in the living metabolism. So it's really fascinating to me that it's purely just the force and the heat and the impact can force this oxidation, but it's not, there's a natural explanation for everything. And it's not because of where it came from necessarily, but a chemical reaction that made it happen. And he says that minerality is a quality often touted by wine specialists. Oh dear. When I read this, I was like, oh, where are we going with this one? By wine specialists as somehow derived directly from specific vineyard soils and their underlying limestone or granite or schist. Sound familiar yet? In fact, the volatiles that have been identified to date as actually contributing stony smells to wine are the product of grape growing and winemaking practices. It seems fairly certain that wine minerality doesn't come directly from soil minerals. It comes at least in part from wine molecules that are reminiscent of or identical with molecules that can also be generated from minerals. It's less handy as a sales pitch for wine or for a wine critic's expertise, but how remarkable is it? And so it's, I mean, again, I felt like I was like blowing up theory after theory with my review last week, and I sort of feel the same way. But one thing he really tackles on, and again, in a later chapter, dealing with all manner of fungi, and of course, yeast are single cell fungi, and yeast is responsible for the creation of wine. It metabolizes the sugar in grape juice and turns it into this fermented product that we know and we love and we talk about. And what he says, and what I'm more and more convinced of, is that what determines the flavor in a wine is largely due to, I mean, there are impacts, of course, of climate and where it's grown and the grape, but it's really about the winemaking. And one thing that's so interesting is that the volatiles and smells that we can identify in specific wine grapes are oddly barely detectable in the raw grape juice. And he talks about how he was firsthand working a harvest at a vineyard in upstate New York, and the winemaker invited him to taste the juice of freshly crushed Riesling grapes. And he said it was generically fruity, little more. And he says, and then the winemaker gave him some actively fermenting juice, and it was strongly citrusy and floral. And he quotes the pioneering enologist, Emile Peynot, and he says, who said, wine smells more of fruit than of the grape itself. And so it's so interesting. And it, just think about that. I mean, I know we're not able to travel so much, but if you find yourself in a vineyard and it's the time of year where the grapes are fully ripe, and I would love to hear a winemaker weigh in on this. It's so fascinating that, you know, if you were to pluck a fully ripe Riesling grape off the vine or a Cabernet Sauvignon grape, and then, you know, it's going to certainly have a sweet, fruity taste, but is it going to be as complex and finessed as the final wine. No, what happens in the meantime? Winemaking. And so it's really fascinating to like hone in on this cause and effect. And I think, you know, for this huge book that is not really about wine at all, what it does is explains this cause and effect. And if you're a person like me who likes to know why things are the way they are and know that explanation, then it's really, it's incredibly fascinating for that in that regard. This book ends on a very, on page 592, on a very kind of hopeful note. I mean, so much of what this book details is known scientific fact. It's been studied and it's been isolated and it's been written about for years, decades. And it's very, very, very comprehensive, but there are also unknowns and we don't know everything about, you know, the natural earth. And so it is really fascinating to kind of scratch the surface and dig a little bit deeper and understand what these molecules are that create certain smells and see how they exist in different foods and beverages and different aspects of nature, and then be able to draw some comparisons. This book is not going to tell you how to differentiate one wine from another. This is not a book about wine, but it really is going to, I think, help with sort of the background and make you a more, certainly more chemically savvy person as a result. I should say that wine is not the only fermented beverage that is detailed. This book is exhaustive and it covers all manner of fermented wines, rice wines. It talks about beer and spirits distilled from plant roots and stems. I mean, it's really impressive. And of course, the book does conclude with the author's experience with his second grouse. He went back to the same restaurant, ordered the same whole roasted rare wild game bird. And what's so interesting is that he didn't have the same visceral reaction. And that's where he talks about the idea that something can only be new once. And the first time he had the grouse, he didn't know what to expect. And so it was shocking. And the second time he knew and was kind of prepared to be shocked. And so it was still pungent. It was still gamey, but it was, he was a little bit more well-prepared. And so it was just kind of an interesting way to bring it full circle. I will say what's really funny also at the end is when he tips off his 30 pages of additional references, he talks about how he got hooked on research and writing in the 1970s. And he spent a lot of time in the university where he was in the library. And so, of course, there is a chart that details some smells of old books, component smells, their sources, and the molecules that are responsible for them. I mean, every I is dotted and every T is crossed in this book. So what works? So much. This book is genius. Harold McGee is amazing. He's a very, I mean, for this book is like a chemistry textbook. And he does say, and I appreciate this very much, and I did follow his advice, that you don't necessarily have to read this book in order that it's presented. You can skip around, you can graze, as he said. And I did do that because I was obviously searching for knowledge as it relates to wine and the terms that we use to talk about wine and how we smell certain things. But he does cross-reference and mention things on other pages. And so I kept going back and looking through. So I read the whole book, but I skipped around. And I don't usually do that. But the advice was there from the author. So I appreciate that very much. It details, I mean, there are chemical diagrams and there are charts and there are more names for esters and amines and alcohols and acids. And it's a lot. You know, I definitely slept my way through a lot of chemistry classes in college and maybe even in high school. It's a subject that I am fascinated by, but it somehow has the ability to put me to sleep. And it took a little bit to get into this book. And I did actually go and reread the beginning section about the formation of the universe and the smelly molecules and how we smell them a couple times because I felt like I glazed over. But then as it started talking about, you know, fascinating flowers, he visually lays it out. And, you know, imagine an English garden where it's segmented into section by section. And in this first section, we're going to see this type of plant and all the things that they have in common. Now, if we move forward through the garden, it's very visual. And I mean, this would be like the trippiest movie ever. The only thing that I think could have made this book better is if it was a scratch and sniff book. Like it's, I mean, I don't know how that would be like, it'd be like a durian. You wouldn't be able to keep it, which he analyzes in this book, of course. But you wouldn't be able to keep it in your house because all the smells would be so overpowering. But if you love scratch and sniff books when you were a little kid, I did. I mean, that would be pretty amazing. And there are certainly things detailed in this book that I've never had experience with. And so I would be curious. But you know what? I feel empowered to be a smell explorer and collect all my badges. I can't really think of anything that could improve this book because it's so approachable for a book that's so dense. I was very pleased that reading this book on smells and chemistry right after a book about geology, and there was so much overlap and so much consensus between these two scientists. So my opinions are evolving as they should, but they are getting, I'm getting more firm in my opinions on cause and effect for some of these characteristics that we see in wine. As for what doesn't work, I mean, this book is great. It's not a wine book, and that's not the book's fault. This book is fantastic, and I don't know who could write a better book about this subject because the level of expertise is conveyed in such a user-friendly manner. That said, for a podcast about books about wine, this is not a wine book, and I wasn't entirely sure what to expect, and so I thought maybe there would be more, but I mean, it's a catalog of like the whole universe's smells. So wine is just one wee part of that. And so actually that makes complete sense. So for my rating, this is a tricky one because I love this book, but I don't think this book is for everybody. And it's not about wine. It's about one aspect of one thing that we talk about with wine. And frankly, a lot of people who enjoy wine don't really dissect or care to know about the component molecules and the cause and effect of, you know, that delicious Sangiovese that I drank last night, like what makes it, you know, taste like sour cherries and pomegranate. And so you can definitely source some of that information in this book, but it would be a very circuitous route. And there's probably other sources if you want a little bit more wine information. So to that end, and I want to be very clear, my rating is a borrow, but it has nothing to do with the quality and the amazingness of this book. It's purely because I don't think this book is for everyone. And so I would feel badly that if someone wanted to buy this book thinking they would, you know, revolutionize their ability to speak about wine, because I don't think it's going to do that. But it's not the book's fault. It's just, you know, caveat emptor, let the buyer beware. This is a book about the field guide to the world's smells. It delivers what it promises. And it's, I mean, it says nosedive, but this is a deep dive. And it's a really fantastic read. Thank you so much for listening. Don't forget to subscribe, download. You can find us wherever you get your pods. And if you like what you hear, leave us a rating. This episode was sponsored by Blinders. Blinders is a highly strategic, addictive, and insanely fun card game that allows anyone to learn and compete in their own blind tasting at home. You can get 30% off with Reading 30. That's Reading 30 for your purchase of Blinders.